So thanks everybody for coming here at 9 a.m. in the morning. I'm sort of half asleep myself, so I imagine you guys are probably in even worse shape. So what I'll talk about today is something that Brent and I did some time ago on queries on encrypted data. I just want to tell you what the problem settings are and some applications and some constructions for these things. The talk is actually an hour long, so I'm going to talk really fast and compress it into 4 minutes. Last time I did it, it didn't work too well. I gave a tutorial here, but we'll see how it goes today. But anyhow, I'll stop. Where's he at? I'll stop at 9:50. Okay, so let's start with a couple of motivating examples for why do we need to do queries on encrypted data. So here's a kind of a fake example. I'll give a more realistic example in a minute. But imagine, again, the Visa system. So here you have a point of sale terminal that sort of takes credit cards, sends credit card transactions over to some Visa gateway. The Visa gateway looks at the value of the transaction, you know, whether it's over, say, $1,000 or less. So if it's over $1,000, it sends the transaction to some high security processor. Otherwise, it sends the transaction to a low security processor. So let's just pretend for a second that that's how the system works. So this is all nice and fine, no problems at all. The problem, of course, you know, as Visa is trying to move into encryption throughout the entire payment system, they're actually talking about encryption at the point of sale terminal. And the way this would, in the long-term vision, this is very far from being deployed, of course, is that the point of sale terminal encrypted using the public key of an acquirer. But let's, to make things simple, let's just assume the point of sale terminal encrypts a transaction using the public key of Visa. At this point, the gateway, of course, just sees encrypted traffic, and it has no way of telling whether the transaction is worth over $1,000 or not. So the traditional solution to this is just take the Visa secret key and stick it on the gateway. So now the gateway can decrypt, and then again it can answer this question, this predicate. But this seems like the wrong design, right? If all you need to do is just test whether something is greater than 1,000 or not, it seems like the wrong thing to do to actually give you this high security key on something that's exposed to the outside world. Ideally, what we'd like to do is delegate and generate some sort of a secret token that just allows you to answer this question but learn nothing else about the transaction. Okay, that's kind of our goal. So what we'd like to do is basically have the master secret, which is what Visa uses, basically generate a token, I'll call it T1000, that is going to be installed on the gateway and only allows the gateway to learn whether the value is greater than 1,000 or not, but learn nothing else about the transaction. Nothing else. Now, from a technical point of view, I'll tell you that when the value is over 1,000, for technical reasons, perhaps the gateway should also obtain some sort of data. If you remember, there's a little bit of data in the transaction, and maybe if the predicate is true, we want the processor to obtain some data and send it over to the actual high security processor. So that's an example of a query that we'd like to do on encrypted data, just test whether this predicate is true and learn nothing else about the plain text. Now you can imagine more sophisticated queries. For example, if the value is greater than 1,000 and the expiration date is not too far into the future, again, you know, you send it to different types of processors. So the standard, when you start thinking about how to do these conjunctive type queries, the first thing that comes to mind is pretty simple, right? Just give a predicate for this, just give a trapdoor for this predicate, whether the value is greater than 1,000 or not, and then give another trapdoor for this predicate, whether the expiration date is in the future or not. Unfortunately, that doesn't really work. And the reason it doesn't work is because the gateway would learn more information than it really should, right? You would see if you have a trapdoor for both these predicates, if the entire predicate is not satisfied, the actual gateway would learn which of these two conjuncts actually failed. What happened?
I lied to you. I'll tell you later.
Oh, you lied to me. Okay. Thanks. yes. Got it. Okay, I know what you mean.
All right.
Yeah, I got it. Okay, so... okay, now I lost my train of thought. Anyhow, so you can't just give two trapdoors that allow you to test these two predicates separately, because if the entire predicate is false, that leaks more information about the transaction that you really need. All you'd like to do is just the gateway should just be able to tell whether this conjunction is true or false and learn nothing else. Okay, so how do we handle these conjunction predicates is something that we'll look at in this talk. So another example, so again, we're going to generate a trapdoor for this entire conjunction, and that's what we put on the server. So another example, maybe a more realistic example, is email. So imagine, again, we have a mail filter, a mail server, that says, If the email is from a spam source, just go ahead and trash the email. Okay? So that all works nice and fine. That's how the world actually works today. SpamHaus, by the way, is a standard, it's a blacklisting service for various spam sources. But of course, again, if the email is encrypted, now the poor mail server is sort of stuck. It can't really, the mail is encrypted using Alice's public key, and the mail, again, can't tell who the email, the server can't really tell who the email is from. So again, Alice is going to give a token to the mail server that says, if this email is from a SpamHaus source, go ahead and throw the email into the trash can, otherwise let it through. And again, the goal is to say, if the email is from one of these sources, you should throw it away, but if it's not, if it is from one of these sources, you should throw it away, but you shouldn't learn which exact source it's from. You should just learn that the source address is one of the sets that you're not interested in. But you shouldn't learn exactly which address it's from. So that's one example. And again, you can imagine conjunctive queries. So, you know, if the email is from a friend, I was going to write here an NSF program manager. It's friends. Yeah, and say the subject is urgent, then, you know, you do appropriate, or maybe you route it to your cell phone or something. Yeah, when I talk about this at NSF, I put NSF program manager, so anything there. Getting preferential treatment. Okay, so anyhow, so it's the same problem, of course, that we can't just give the mail server two predicates. We have to somehow give them a predicate that can do the conjunction of these two without leaking any other information. Okay, so that gives you examples of predicates that we'd like to handle. So we talked about comparison predicates, greater than 1,000 or not. We talked about equality predicates, and we talked about subset predicates. So those are sort of classes of predicates we're going to look at here. Yeah.
Do you allow the mail server to know the predicate? Or?
Yes, we allow it. In fact, Rafi has worked on cases where you don't allow the mail server to know the predicate, but that's not in the model for this talk. Okay, so you can sort of see that this is a long-term program in that the goal here is to build a public key encryption system where you can do arbitrary predicates. Well, arbitrary, I mean any polynomial-sized circuits. Right now, all we can do is really just conjunctions of comparisons and subset queries and equality queries, but not really any predicates. So we can't do things like regular expressions. We can't do things like substring queries. So you can imagine a very rich set of classes of predicates that we'd like to be able to answer on encrypted data. And the challenge is to come up with a system that basically can support any type of query you'd like. But we're very far away from that.
Another clarification. So where is the sender of the the underlying language, the sender of them, piece of mail. What does he know about the predicate?
He doesn't know anything about the predicate.
Nothing
about the predicate. He just knows how the system works. So he knows how to encrypt, but he doesn't know what we're interested in. Yeah, I'll get into exact definitions in just a minute. Just motivating examples. So I'll tell you, like in the long term, so we're nowhere near able to do this, but in the long term, what we'd like to be able to do is, you know, the vision is to say, you know, I want to do spam filtering on encrypted data, so I'd like to be able to give the mail server a token that allows them to test whether an encrypted piece of email is spam or not, but learn nothing else about the email, right? So that's kind of the long-term vision, which would be kind of nice, to do spam filtering on encrypted data without learning anything else about the email. So the way that you can imagine this would work is say, who's like a spam service out there, like a standard spam service, say a Brightmail is an example of a spam filtering service. So you can imagine maybe once a day, Brightmail publishes a spam predicate, right? What does it mean for an email to be spam? Once a day, they update it based on spams on the internet.
Once a day, the spammers update their programs.
Yeah, once a day, they update, exactly, the spammers also move. So then once a day, Alice sort of goes and gets her spam predicate for the day. She generates a token for that predicate, gives the token to the mail server, and now the mail server can throw away all mail that matches that spam predicate. Okay, so that's the long-term vision, but we're nowhere near there. No, we're not. We're nowhere near there. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done here. Lots of nice open problems. Okay. All right. So this problem actually has some history. So if you look at most of the work to date, mostly focuses on equality queries, not so much on more general comparison or subset queries. So this started with the work of Song Wagner at Pairing in 2000, turns out where they focused on queries on symmetrically encrypted data. It turns out earlier work of Rafi and Oleg Bogreich on Livius Rams gives sort of similar results. In the public key settings, myself, DeSantis, Ostrowski, and Prisciano, and Abdallah, and Delare, and lots of other people, sort of looked at encryptions, doing quality queries on public key encrypted data. There is work, again, by Rafi, and Brent, and Song, and others, on basically what Amos was asking, what quality queries that sort of hide the predicate who we're interested in. And finally, Bodorova and Delare have some work on, recent work on sort of deterministic encryption that allows you to do efficient equality searches in a database. So you notice that most of the work focuses on equality searches. There's one exception. There's a paper from CMU by Bethencourt et al. That looks at range queries, but that's in a much weaker security model than what we're considering here. So that sort of gives you an idea of what's been done in this area. And here we're going to focus on more of these more general predicates. Yeah?
When did Eugene go to? Was something similar to that?
Not quite. You mean the
it looked like searches when I looked at the
You mean data. Using the hash tables? Not quite. Let's talk about that. Yeah, it's not quite. Okay. All right. So let's talk about. Okay. So let's go into more of the formalities, formalisms. So let's define the problem more precisely. So okay. So imagine we have a collection of predicates. So we're going to call phi a collection of predicates. So what's a predicate? A predicate is basically something that maps an alphabet, a finite alphabet, into 0, 1. And for example, you can think of comparison predicates. So pj of m is 1 if m is greater than j. So the number of predicates in this class, in this example, is basically the size of sigma. Okay, so if sigma is the numbers 1 to n, we'll have n different comparison predicates, one for every value of j. So I give you a class of predicates, and now your goal is to construct a public key system that would allow me to answer queries on any of these predicates on encrypted data. Okay? So the challenge, if you like, the long-term challenge is to build a public key system that supports arbitrary, complicated families of predicates. Right now, we can only do specific ones. Hopefully, these classes will expand over time. So what is a phi query system? So it's a system specifically for this predicate family. Well, as usual, it has a setup algorithm, takes a security parameter, and spits out a public key and a secret key. It has an encrypt algorithm that takes two parameters. Okay, it takes the search value, so this would be, say, the value of the transaction or the source address of an email, and then it takes some other transaction data. This M is actually not that important. The focus here should be on this S. This is the search value. And then it produces a ciphertext. Okay, so for any value that we can search on, we get a ciphertext. That's how the encryption works. So this is what the person sending you an email would do. It would run the encrypt algorithm. Now, Alice would run what's called a gen token algorithm. So she uses her long-term secret key and an arbitrary predicate. This just means a description of the predicate from phi, and generates a token for this predicate. Okay, so far so good. So Alice generates this token, say, once a day. She gives this token to the mail server, and then the mail server runs a query algorithm. So given a ciphertext and a predicate, the mail server basically either decrypts and receives the message M if the predicate is satisfied, and otherwise it just gets null. So that's our goal. Make sense? Now, I'm a little fudging here just in the interest of time. It turns out the correctness property is actually a little bit more complicated to state than what I said here. In fact, what we do is we insist that this is null only with high probability, not high probability over the random bits used by the encrypt algorithm. We don't insist that it's always null. This is just for some technical reasons. All right? So there's some small error probability that's going to be here. One thing that that I'd like to point out, actually, is you notice there's no way for anyone here to recover the set S, the search index S. So you can't. There's no decrypt algorithm that would give you this S, because the decrypt algorithm is sort of tangential to this problem. If you really wanted to decrypt and recover S, you would just also encrypt S under an additional public key system, and then Alice could then use the secret key to recover this S without any problem. Okay, so it's tangential to the searching problem by itself, so I'm not going to talk about decryption. All right, so does this make sense? That's kind of the setup. That's the type of systems we're going to be constructing. Everybody's okay with this? Okay. So this is kind of an important slide to remember, because that's what we're going to be looking at. Yeah.
Actually, drop the message?
I'm sorry?
The predicate matches.
Yeah, that's kind of the point. If the predicate is true, then we output the message. Now, as I said, this message is not really that important. You can think of this message, if all you're interested in is just testing whether the transaction is over $1,000 or not, really this message could just be zero, the number zero. So if it's over $1,000, you'll get zero, and you'll know the transaction is over $1,000. If it's less than $1,000, you'll get bottom.
But this is something that the sender has to be aware of.
Yes. It's part of the description of the system. Exactly how this works is part of the description of the system.
And
the sender just runs the encrypt.
Not the semantics, but at least the alphabet of it.
Yeah. So again, I just want to make sure this is clear. The encryptor, the sender, basically encrypts the transaction value in here and maybe extra transaction data in here. And the mail server runs the query algorithm and either gets the extra transaction data or gets nothing. That's, again, the image you should have in your mind. Okay. So that's kind of the functional description of what we're going to build. Now let's talk about how do we define security. So before I actually give you the formal definition, let's just build some intuition. So let's look at the set of comparison queries. So again, for every j, there's a predicate pj that's true if x is greater than j and false otherwise. These are comparison queries. And we're going to allow the adversary to ask for any tokens of its choice. Okay, so it can ask for, you know, a token for testing, comparing to A, comparing to B, comparing to C, and so on. Now, given all these tokens, we'd like to say that the system still has semantic security. So what does that mean? Well, basically, obviously, if I encrypt X between A and B and Y between B and C, well, obviously, there's not going to be any semantic security. Obviously, the adversary can use this token to distinguish an encryption of X from an encryption of Y. So semantic security somehow has to take this into account. On the other hand, if I give the adversary an encryption of X and an encryption of Z, so they all lie on the same side of all the predicates, of all the tokens in a sense, then these two ciphertexts should be indistinguishable. That's kind of what we're shooting for. So just keep this image in mind, and now let me give you the actual security definition. So it's kind of cute. Okay, so what is a fee query system? Well, so again, so it's semantic security when the adversary has a bunch of tokens. The challenger runs the setup algorithm and sends the public key to the attacker. Now the attacker gets to ask for the trapdoor for arbitrary tokens of its choice, for any P in the predicate family. And, the challenger just gives those tokens to the adversary. Okay, now comes the semantic security challenge. So the adversary outputs two messages, so a message is a pair. Right, it's got the search index and the data, search index and data. And the only requirement, what we require here, is that basically for all the tokens that the adversary has, it had better be the case that the search strings on both challenges sort of fall on the same side of these predicates. So they're always all the same. Yeah, that makes sense? It's kind of a reasonable thing. So, you don't have this case where S0 is under B, but S1 is over B, and the adversary can trivially distinguish the two. It turns out there's another requirement, just because of these M's. I don't want to describe this too much. There's another requirement that I'll say if M0 is not equal to M1, then it turns out all the predicates have to be false. Again, otherwise this is necessary for the definition not to be violated trivially. But let me not talk about that. This is not so important. The main point is this restriction. So then, of course, as usual, the adversary gets the encryption of one of these, and his goal is to tell which one he got. Ah, animation went the wrong way. Goes that way. Of course, actually, I just ran out of space on the slide, but of course, the adversary can continue to issue these queries after seeing the challenge as well, subject to these restrictions. Okay, so far so good. So that's kind of the security notion we're going to be shooting for. Actually, not quite. As usual, we do the usual cheats. And relax our definition just a little bit to talk about selective security. So selective security just means that instead of allowing the adversary to choose S0, S1 after seeing a bunch of private keys, we actually force them to commit to S0 and S1 ahead of time. So again, we restrict the adversary's power a little bit. He has to commit to things ahead of time, and as a result, it's a little bit easier to build systems that are secure in these settings. Okay, so actually that's the security model that we're going to be shooting for. So we have full adaptive security for M0 and M1, just S0 and S1 have to be committed to ahead of time. Okay, so having said all that, let's look at our first construction. So the first construction is kind of obvious. Yeah, it's kind of, if I give you this problem, you ask, well, what can we build?
Yeah. What do you want? I'm not sure. Okay, go back.
Yes. What's the problem?
This thing, you said it's most important, I didn't understand. All JPJ of SE or EPJ of S1. What's going on?
Oh, why is this necessary? Okay. Why this condition?
Well, I don't understand what you want to do. I mean, I just said your examples.
Yeah.
I don't understand the definition. Maybe you can work out an example.
Oh, sure. Yeah, let me explain. No, this is actually an important point, so I'd like to make sure it's clear. Mm-hmm. So think of, maybe I'm abstracting things a little bit.
No, you're using the word tractor, CKP, and tokens, I think, so that confused me also.
Ah, okay.
Same thing.
Good, thanks. Okay, so there's a secret key that's used to generate trapdoors. Oh, sorry. Okay, no trapdoors in this world. Let's forget the word trapdoors. Okay. So there's a secret key that Alice has, say, and she uses that's like a master secret that she keeps forever. She uses that master secret to basically generate tokens for arbitrary predicates of her choice. So what we allow the adversary to do is basically get arbitrary tokens for any predicate he wants. So think of predicates, again, the image in mind, you should have in mind is these greater than predicates. So greater than A, greater than B, greater than C. He has these tokens that he can now test, he can now, given any ciphertext, he can now answer he can answer those questions about the plaintext. So obviously, we want to make sure that S0 and S1, so none of these tokens that he already has allow him to trivially distinguish an encryption of S0 from an encryption of S1. So how do we make sure none of these tokens allow him to trivially break the system? Basically, we say that for all the predicates that he has tokens for, the two have to follow the same stuff. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it says. So yeah, exactly. So even though he has a bunch of tokens, this definition captures exactly this concept that nothing else is revealed about the plaintext. Yeah, precisely. So for example, in the conjugation example, if you just give if I do predicate P1 and predicate P2, if I give you separate tokens for P1 and P2, then this would not be true.
Oh, just
No, this is actually an important point. So thanks for, I want to make sure this is clear. Yeah, so as I said, this is kind of a standard cheat in this whole, you're going to see in just a minute, this is kind of abstract notions, but they're all closely related to what's called an anonymous IDE. And there's a standard cheat where we sort of force the adversary to commit to a few things ahead of time that reduces the adversary's power and makes it a lot easier for us to build systems that satisfy these definitions.
Recalling to you.
Yeah.
Would it make a difference to the definition if you allow them after seeing the challenge to ask for more tokens as long as
they're
still satisfied?
We allow them actually. I just ran out of space on the slide. But we actually allow the adversary to ask for more tokens after the challenge, but again, subject to these conditions. Yeah, that's exactly right. And by the way, you can strengthen this definition to talk about chosen ciphertext security. Again, you just have to make sure there are you just have to ignore trivialities would allow the adversary to trivially win the game. But you can basically strengthen this in a couple of ways. But I just want to get the basic idea across. Okay, thanks. Yeah. All right, so let's look at our first construction, which is what we call the trivial system, because it really is trivial. So here, let me explain how it works. So we have a collection of predicates that we're trying to satisfy. So we want to build a system that's searchable for these predicates. And the algorithm is a general public key system. And so the algorithms work as follows. So setup algorithm essentially generates n public key, private key pairs. N is the number of predicates in our family. So we just generate n public-private key pairs. You can probably see where I'm going with this. And then the way we encrypt, is basically to say, well, if I want to encrypt a value, a search string s, what I do is I either encrypt m or encrypt junk, depending on whether the predicate is satisfied or not. And I just output this vector of ciphertext. Okay? So you can pretty much see how this is going to work. So how do I generate a token for a particular predicate? Well, what I do for predicate number I, just allow you to decrypt the ith ciphertext, and that will either be junk or the message, depending on whether the ith predicate is satisfied or not. So this is kind of obvious. Either way, the way you do queries, basically you just run a decrypt algorithm on the ith, using the ith secret key, essentially. Okay, so this is the trivial system, and that's the one, since really this is the only thing that was known up until this point, we're going to compete against this trivial system. So our goal is to do much better. So notice that the ciphertext length is linear in the number of predicates in our family, and the tokens, of course, are constant size. Well, you know, O of lambda, but let's pretend for a minute. It's independent of n, that's what I'm saying. Yeah?
So, in this construction, I guess the definitions in general, there's no notion of testing for well-formed methods, right?
Yeah, actually, I'll talk about that later on. Yeah. I'll talk about that later on. It turns out that's actually a really, really good point. You know, let me talk about that towards the end. So here, again, we're trusting the adversary to sort of run the encryption algorithm correctly. So in fact, in the spam example, you would have to include, the big hammer to solve this problem is you would have to include some sort of a NISIC to argue that the ciphertext was built correctly. But it turns out in the construction that we actually give, there's better solutions. So I'll talk about that at the end. You can sort of, I'll just say it now. You can sort of test whether a ciphertext is built correctly given the master secret. So you can sort of, if a secret key makes it past the filtering, before you decrypt, you can test that it's well-formed, and if it's not, you just throw it on the floor. That's kind of the idea. Okay, but that's a really good point.
Sort of defeats the point of filtering.
No,
it doesn't. It doesn't. The user still wouldn't see the message. Right, your
right.
Outlook would
the,
throw
the filter requires the secret key.
No.
Filter.
So filtering does the usual. So again, there are two solutions. There's a NISIC solution, which we're perfectly fine.
Yeah.
The other solution, which is kind of a hack, the other solution is to say, well, we can do a well-formedness test using the master secret key. So if you get past the filter, still Outlook doesn't have to know what the spam predicate is. You can just throw away all ciphertexts that are malformed.
There's no point in sending such spam because you know that it would not.
It would never be displayed to the user. But anyhow,
it puts the computational load is now on the Outlook, which does the testing for. You know, if I'm sending a billion spam messages. To Outlook has
if
to
they're malformed. Yeah, if they're malformed. Yeah, that's
so
right.
The point of
you
can
still
mount
a DOS attack.
I have 15 minutes. So the main solution to that you should have in mind is a NISIC based solution. And we have terrific GOS. We have terrific NISICs in the world today. So it's not that expensive to include a NISIC. Everything we're doing is using. Actually, yeah. We'll talk about it offline. Good. Okay. Thanks. All right. So where are we? So we saw the trivial system, and that's actually the system we're going to compete against. Now, before I show you, let me just show you sort of a summary of what we can do today. So this is based on. Let me explain. All right, so I'm going to look at three types of predicates. So equality predicates, comparison predicates, and subset predicates. So subset predicates, remember, are predicates of the form. The from address in the email is in the set of spam sources. Okay, so those are the type of predicates we want to look at. Now, the trivial system that we just saw by just encrypting things using a vector, so for equality predicates, well, if it were over a universal size n, there are n equality predicates. So the trivial system would have ciphertext of size n, well, n times lambda, but let's ignore lambda. Comparison predicates would have, but again, there are n comparison predicates, so we would have ciphertext of size n. For subset predicates, of course, there are 2 to the n different subsets, so we would have exponential size ciphertext. So the trivial system kind of completely dies for these types of predicates. The lower bounds, the amount of information we're actually encrypting is just a number between 1 and n. So really, the lower bound on the ciphertext size is just log n. So you can see we're pretty far away, the trivial system is pretty far away from the lower bound, especially in the case of subset predicates. And what we can do now, and there's actually lots of work left to do, so in the case of equality queries, this is sort of the work of myself and Rafi and DeSantis and Persiano, in the case of equality predicates, we're pretty much at the lower bound. So we have short ciphertext and everybody's happy. For comparison predicates, this is the work of myself, Amit Sahai, and Brent. We actually have, the best we can do is really ciphertext of size squared of n. And this is already, this is already kind of quite a feat. And it would be quite nice, the system is fairly complicated, and it would be nice to have a simpler system. More importantly, it would be really nice to have a system of size log n. It seems doable, but we just have no idea how to even approach this. So there's a really, really nice open problem here. Doing comparison predicates with much smaller ciphertexts. For subset queries, this is kind of the new results, Brent and myself, that kind of shows how to do much better than the trivial system, but still very far away from the lower bound. So there's a lot of work left to be done on improving these sort of constructions. Okay, so again, this shows you there's lots of very nice open problems here, and this all seems very relevant. And I'm going to show you other applications of this in just a minute, but this seems to be a rich set of problems. And of course, as I said, we'd like to expand the set of predicates we can do. So one thing we can already do today is deal with conjunctive predicates. So it gives you a conjunction of equalities, conjunctions of comparisons, or conjunctions of subsets. The trivial system sort of blows up in the obvious way, right? There are n to the w different predicate conjunctive equality predicates. So things sort of blow up in the way you would expect. And again, the constructions that we have just generalize in a natural way. Just everything multiplies by w. So again, you can see that we're very far from the lower bound for comparison and for subset queries, so there's interesting work left to be done here. Yeah?
Can I do move from square of n to an n?
Yes, we don't know how to do square of n w in this case. Yeah, even that is already open. Yeah?
It's better than square root of n to the w.
It's what? Oh, yeah. Actually, initially, when we started looking at this, we thought we would have a W times square root of n, but that doesn't work. The system doesn't compose with itself. So we can only do just a little bit better than trivial. Okay. All right. So what I want to do next is kind of show you that this is kind of a neat framework. So we'll talk about some connections between searching on encrypted data and existing problems. In particular, I want to show you that it's kind of a very general framework for various properties of encryption. So I want to show you that, in fact, comparison queries imply trader tracing. This is kind of a neat reduction, so I want to show you the details. Membership queries, so given there are n predicates and you're encrypting actually subsets, so membership queries imply what's called private broadcast encryption. So private broadcast encryption refers to broadcast encryption where the recipient set is not known to anyone. So looking at the ciphertext doesn't tell you who the recipient set is. it implies some variance of broadcast encryption. And equality queries essentially are anonymous IP. these things are all related. So anonymous IP refers to an IP system where looking at the ciphertext doesn't tell you the identity that it was encrypted under. All right, so it's kind of nice that it captures all these things. I want to show you the reduction to trader tracing because it's kind of cute. So it's kind of a classic result, but it's something that it's kind of fun to see. Okay, so comparison queries, I want to show you give a very simple, in a very simple way, indirect way, give you a trader tracing system. Yes, I assume people here are familiar with trader tracing? Yes, no? Okay, fine, good. So in just two words, what does trader tracing mean? Well, you have a radio station that's broadcasting data to the whole world. Every recipient has a different key that allows it to decrypt their transmission. And the point is, if somebody exposes their secret key and builds what's called a pirate decoder, then we'd like to find that person and go shoot him. Okay? Or if there's a coalition of people that uses their keys to build a pirate decoder, we'd just like to find one of the pirates and kill them, or the cryptographic equivalents of killing somebody, revoking their keys. Okay, so that's kind of the goal of trader tracing. If you remember the definition of trader tracing, again, it's a collection of four algorithms. There's a setup algorithm, spits out a bunch of private keys and a public key. Okay, so every recipient gets one of these secret keys. So user I gets private key ki. There's an encryption algorithm, there's a decryption algorithm, and the important piece of a trader tracing system is the tracing algorithm. So the tracing algorithm basically interacts with the pirate decoder as an oracle. So it's a black box. We're going to view the pirate decoder as a stateless black box circuit, and the tracing algorithm just issues queries to this pirate decoder, and after interacting with the pirate decoder, it's supposed to output the identity of at least one guilty party. All right, that's kind of what a trader tracing system does. I won't show you the exact security definition game in the interest of time, but let me show you a reduction from comparison queries to trader tracing. So how does this work? Well, yes, I want to show you the comparison queries very simply give you a trader tracing system. Well, so here's how the system works. So the setup algorithm basically what it'll do is it'll generate the public key and the secret key for the searchable system. So we get two keys for the searchable system, and then the private key that's given to each one of the legitimate users, each one of the radios that can decrypt the satellite transmissions, basically is the token that corresponds to the ith predicate. Okay, so this predicate, remember, is a comparison predicate. So this is a token that allows you to decrypt any message which is smaller than I. Okay? Now, the way we normally encrypt in the system is basically we encrypt using searchable index 1. So since every I is greater than 1, any user in the system can actually decrypt the ciphertext. Yeah, is that clear? I mean, the tokens allow anyone to decrypt the ciphertexts. Right, so the way we decrypt is simply using the query algorithm, and this works since I is always greater than 1, and the question is, how do we do tracing? So to do tracing, actually, we're going to use larger values of I when we actually encrypt. So this is actually a very cute trick, so let me show you how this works. So it's a very general tracing mechanism. It's been used, you know, in a lot of papers on trivial tracing, but it's kind of nice to cast it in this queries on encrypted data language so that you can see that it's a very general mechanism. So here's what we do. Okay, so now we capture a pirate decoder. So let's call it G. Okay, so we get to interact with this pirate decoder as a black box, as an oracle. We just give it queries and it decrypts things for us. Now, we're going to define a bunch of values, P1, P2, up to PN plus 1. And the way we're going to define them is basically, we're going to give the pirate decoder lots of ciphertexts, but these are malformed ciphertexts, right? So rather than encrypting using index 1, we encrypt using arbitrary indices. So, you know, the value PJ is defined by encrypting a value J and then asking whether the pirate decoder can actually decrypt. Right? So we basically measure how many times the pirate decoder succeeds in decrypting for a particular J. So now it's not very hard to see that in fact P1 means we're encrypting to index number 1. So if this pirate decoder is of any use, so P1 basically captures all legitimate ciphertexts because we're legitimately encrypting using index 1. So if this pirate decoder is of any use, P1 had better be very close to 1, right? Because it has to decrypt valid ciphertexts. On the other hand, Pn plus 1, so if we stick an n plus 1 here, then all the comparison predicates are false, because I is never greater than n plus 1. So all the comparison predicates are false. So Pn plus 1 has to be close to 0, because nobody can decrypt. None of the private keys can decrypt, so the decoder cannot decrypt either. That would violate the semantic security properties of the system. So P1 is large, Pn plus 1 is small, so that just screams for a hybrid argument. So in fact, that's what we do. So we say, well, let's look at the difference of the two. So Pn plus 1 minus P1 is greater than 1 minus epsilon. And that implies, just by triangular inequality, that there must exist an I where there's a gap between Pi plus 1 and Pi. Right? There's a big gap between these two, so there must exist some point where there's a small gap between these two. But now look what happens. Essentially, what we're saying is that this pirate decoder can distinguish between an index I here and an index I plus 1 here. But if it can distinguish index I from index I plus 1, by, again, the semantic security definition of comparison queries, that can only be done if you have the trapdoor for predicate I. And if you have the trapdoor for predicate I, that means user I is one of the pirates. Okay, so that's kind of the standard argument for tracing. And again, it shows you in a very clean way that comparison queries directly imply an efficient trader tracing mechanism. So in principle, how do you actually trace? What does the tracing algorithm actually look like? Well, you're going to estimate this PI by just plugging in lots of random messages. You know, use churn out bounds to obtain a PI hat, an approximation of PI. So you need n squared samples to get a good approximation of PI, and you need to do that for all n. So it's like a cubic, you basically get a cubic time tracing algorithm. You can actually replace that by a binary search and actually get a quadratic time tracing algorithm. But that's the result of this thing. So we have quadratic time tracing.
This is quadratic in the total number of
users. Yeah, exactly.
And previous tracing algorithms? What?
Oh, they're all over the map.
Are there any that beat that? There are some that beat that?
Yeah. So even if you relax the black box tracing property, you can get linear time tracing. For specific trader tracing construction, you can actually do linear time tracing, but it's not a generic mechanism. Yeah. But also, by the way, I mean, none of the constructions are fully collision resistant. So all these systems that have linear time tracing, there's a limit on how many. If the adversary has more than so many heaps, it'll actually defeat the tracing algorithm. Mm-hmm. So this is the only way we know how to build fully collision resistant tracing.
But,
yeah.
This essentially requires that the coder doesn't know what was the index j that it was encoded in the message.
Yeah, that's what the comparison mechanism gives you.
So the fact that the comparison mechanism
is semantically secure.
Resolve,
yeah, yeah.
That's
exactly the crux of it. That you have to make sure that the index j that you stick in the ciphertext is unknown without the appropriate private key. And that's exactly what the comparison query is. The semantic security of comparison system gives you. Yeah, that's exactly the point. Yeah. So basically, if you're selectively secure, then you get a secure tracing mechanism. Okay. So I have 4 minutes. 4 minutes. How do I do constructions in 4 minutes? Well, let's try. I'll stop at 9:50, and we'll see how far we get with these constructions. Okay. So the constructions, of course, are based on pairings. So not a big surprise. Everything in the world is based on pairings. World hunger and everything. So crash course in pairings. So this is a real crash course. I'm not going to give you much detail beyond this. So we know what a pairing is, I hope. Yes? Yes? Okay. So you know what a pairing is, basically. It's a function that maps two elements in an origin group into a target group. It's got to be bilinear, non-degenerate, and computable. And of course, if you have a pairing, then the decision Diffie-Hellman problem is easy. So if I give you a four tuple, it's easy to test if A is equal to B. You can just verify that this equality holds. Essentially, the A comes out of the parentheses and the B come out of the parentheses. So if A is equal to B, so A is equal to B if and only if this equality holds. So you get a DDH oracle. And it turns out that's actually something we're going to have to fight with in this construction. This is kind of causing a problem for us. Okay. So in fact, we're not going to be using traditional pairings. So traditional pairings work in groups of prime order. We're going to be using pairings in groups of composite order. So this has turned out to be a bit of a gold mine in terms of properties of things that we can do with composite order groups, although I think we're kind of milked as much as we can out of it. So we'll see where this goes in the future. So what is a composite order group? Well, basically it's a group of order n, where n is an RSA modulus, so product of two large primes. And we have a map, basically, again, from G times G to GT. So just in your mind, just so that you know how this is built, so G essentially, this group G is obviously defined over an elliptic curve. The elliptic curve actually is defined over a prime. So we're still working modulo primes. It's just that the order of the group is composite. That's what's happening. Now, I should tell you, the original paper that introduced this, this is a paper of myself, Go, and Kobe Nissen. We just used specific types of bilinear groups, supersingular curves, which are very easy to build with a fixed and prescribed order. And in fact, Alice Silverberg and Carl Rubin have been able to extend that to construct non-supersingular curves even of arbitrary order. So we have lots of constructions basically for groups of this type. So let me show you some properties of these groups. So first of all, since the order is P times Q, obviously, there's a subgroup of size P and a subgroup of size Q. We can write, we can take a generator of the entire group and convert it into a generator of each of these subgroups. So we'll call them GP and GQ. And then we can take any element in the whole group, and sort of project it into these two subgroups. So we can write any element in the whole group as essentially a combination of an element in the P group and an element in the Q group. Now you can tell that I had way too much time on the plane. For animations. Yes. So some properties of these things. So for example, if you pair GP and GQ, well, GP, remember, is G to the Q, and GQ is G to the P. So these two exponents come out, and we get EGG to the power of n, which is basically 1. Okay, so that's kind of nice. If you pair two elements from two distinct groups, you get 1. And in particular, the magical property that we're going to be using is this projection property. So if I take a generator of the P group and an arbitrary element in the entire group, if I pair the two together, the Q part of H kind of dies because of this identity. It just goes to 1. So what happens is if I pair G, P, and H, essentially, I'm like projecting into the P group without ever knowing what A and B are. Right? Because the discrete log problem is hard, actually taking an element and writing in this form requires us to solve discrete log. So this we can't do this. But even though we don't know what A and B are, the pairing just magically projects things into the P group. And this is the identity we're going to keep using over and over and over and over and over and over. This is kind of the main reason why these groups are so useful. So we can sort of blind things by a Q group element, and still during decryption, we can sort of project and land in the P group, and that allows us to decrypt things.
Dan,
yeah?
Since you're not going to be able to finish your talk anyway,
yeah.
Can you tell me what this kind of thing says about things like the knowledge of exponent assumption?
Oh, that's a good question. So what does it say about the knowledge? I think nothing.
About what?
Knowledge of exponent
assumption.
Yeah,
that's a strange assumption, even by my terms.
It's a very strange assumption. The question is, have you actually, will arguments like this just say, you know, go away, don't even try such things?
I don't know. I'd be it would be odd if it has any relation, but I don't know. That's a good question. I have to think about that.
Okay. So
Dan? Yeah.
You can still find into my thoughts on this really instructive.
This call has to start till 10:30. You have 10:30.
No.
Well, we can't think about it for 5 minutes.
Yeah. I think what I'll do, you know, what I'll do is I'll just show you one idea. Basically, I won't show you the whole construction. I'll just show you one idea. Okay. Yeah. And we can manage. So I need 3 minutes, and I'll stop. So I'll steal 3 minutes from you. Okay. Thanks. All right, anyhow, so I kind of showed you the main properties of these composite order groups and how the main identity we're going to be using for decryption. So let me tell you just a high-level idea of how we built the subset query. So I'll give you one example, just the subset query system. So again, what we're trying to achieve is, you know, we're encrypting a number between 1 and n, and we're given a subset, and our goal is to test whether S is an A. Okay, so the predicate, so for every subset we have a predicate, and our goal is to test whether S is an A. So this was the spam example. So the trivial system, since there are 2 to the n predicates, the trivial system has size 2 to the n, and what we're going to do, as I promised, we're basically going to reduce this to a linear size cyphertext. So the initial step is actually not that hard. The initial step is basically we're going to translate the subset problem into a conjunctive equality problem. So what do we do? Well, we take the number that we're encrypting, so it's a number between 1 and n, and we're just going to encode it in unary. So this is where we're going to get a linear size ciphertext. Okay? So we encode it in unary, and let's write this unary encoding as sigma s. Basically, it's a vector of numbers of 0, 1 numbers. So all of them are 0 except one point that's 1, which encodes the number s. And now it's not very hard to see that, in fact, if I give you a subset A, then s is an A, if and only if, basically, if you look at all the elements not in A, then if all these elements are 0, then essentially the only place where this vector can be 1 is a point inside of A. Okay, so if this conjunction is true, then in fact the given S must be in the set A. Does this make sense to me? So what I'm saying is that all the elements outside of A are 0, therefore the only place that this vector can be 1 is inside of A. So that would imply that S is inside of A. So really, we've reduced the subset problem into a conjunctive equality problem. So we just want to solve this conjunction of n different equalities. And the question is how to build a conjunctive equality system. So here, actually, things are going to get quite painful. So that's the part I'm going to skip. So things are going to get quite painful. So I'll just, in two sentences, I'll kind of explain the basic idea. It turns out that it makes a lot of sense. You know, there's strong relations between equality queries and anonymous IDE. So it makes a lot of sense to try and solve the conjunctive equality problem using IDE technology. So traditionally, if you try to use traditional IDE technology, this is kind of the type of ciphertext you get. Let me not explain what's happening here. We're basically encrypting a bit vector, b1 to bn. This is the unary encoding of S. We're encrypting a bit vector. This is kind of the traditional IDE way you would encrypt a bit vector, just stick it in the exponents. And then you would generate tokens. Again, I'm not going to, it doesn't matter so much how. You generate tokens that allow you to test that the sort of things line up if, in fact, the conjunctive equality condition is satisfied. Unfortunately, what happens is, because the DDH problem is easy, this system is insecure. This is not an anonymous IBE system, in a sense. In fact, there's a very simple test that just leaks all the bits that you're encrypting, essentially using the DDH oracle. Okay, so you can look at elements in the ciphertext and elements in the public key, and very easily just fish out what these bits are using the DDH oracle. So the DDH oracle sort of breaks the semantic security of the system. So what we do is, this is where we use composite ordered groups, and kind of the idea is to say, well, rather than encrypt elements as is, we're going to make elements in the private key live in the P group, and then we're going to blind all these elements. We're just blinding them by random elements in the Q group. So really what we publish are elements in the P group blinded by random elements in the Q group. So now they live sort of in the entire group G. And the point is, if now you try to do the DDH attack, essentially in the P group, in the group of order P, the DDH attack will still work. But nobody knows, the adversary doesn't know what the P group is. All he sees are elements in the P group blinded by elements in the Q group. And as a result, if you look at the DDH relation in the entire group, not just in the P group, it simply doesn't hold anymore. So the attack essentially goes away. The DDH problem that we were facing goes away. Okay, so by blinding, this is kind of, again, why this is so cute. So I mean, by blinding, you can sort of kill the DDH oracle, and yet during decryption, there is no problem, because when you decrypt, you're basically going to pair these elements, these are the blinding values in the Q group. You're going to pair these elements with elements in the P group, and the Q part just dies. And essentially, you're able to decrypt. So that's kind of the main idea. Unfortunately, this cannot be proved. You can't prove that this is secure. So we were actually stuck on this for a while, because we don't know how to prove that this mechanism actually satisfies our definition. So finally, actually, Brent had the great idea that we can actually just add a little bit more randomness, so we can sort of make things a little bit more independent, and in the token, sort of throw in one more value that randomizes things, and now we can actually make the proof go through, although based on some, you know, yet another class of funny assumptions. So it's funny assumptions to the rescue, but, you know, these are all kind of reasonable assumptions. So now we have, that gives the system. Okay, so kind of, I think in 1 minute I captured the basic idea. No, well, I tried to catch it. What?
It wasn't 1 minute.
Ah, it wasn't. Oh my God. Okay, so I'll stop.